was always something that was in the back of my mind that I'd like to go to Dublin. I had the bit of experience in the publishing kind of advertising area. As my grandmother used to tell me, I had a neck like a jockey's bollocks. And I said, fuck it, I'll give it a go, see how it goes. And I did. I saw the ad in the paper, rang it, Evening Herald. Said, come on up for an interview. Went up, got the job on a trial basis for a couple of days to see how it goes. And I ended up spending the next 20, 21 years up there. So there was no looking back. Started out as advertising sales for a transport magazine called Commercial Transport and Transport Journal magazine, two of them. Just started out basically selling ad spaces on features and things like that. My first morning, I went up, I actually got mugged in Houston Station. Imagine that irony in that, me being a victim of crime. And I went in to the office kind of late and I was all apologies. I told them what happened. And the secretary went up to the boss and I was to find out subsequently that he thought I was a pity case, he wanted to throw me 50 quid for my time and leave him off home. God love him. Tell him thanks, but no thanks. But then, like I said to you, I kind of took to the job fairly quickly. I was good at it and I was able to make sales within a day or two of being there, which is kind of a tough thing to do. You know, it's not advertising. Advertising is very competitive business, very tough business, and I was just good at it. So he wasn't long changing his tune when he saw what I could do. The boss was a recovering alcoholic himself, hadn't drank in God knows how many years. His name was Bill. Bill was, in some ways, a great boss, and in other ways, he was a tyrant. He wouldn't have spent a lot of time in the office, but when he did, you knew he was there. You know, he kind of ruled with the iron fist.
From Wine Tavern Productions, in association with Go Loud, this is The Gambler. Episode 4, Airplane Bill.
I remember getting my first paycheck the following week. I was given a basic of £150 and then 10% commission on top of any ad revenue that we'd sold. And I remember my first being handed my first paycheck and it was 390 quid in it. I was here like, Jesus, 390. Now, 390 quid in 1991, nice wage. Yeah, nice wage. And I'm finding myself all of a sudden on a Friday afternoon, 390 quid in my pocket, no guards looking for me, nothing wrong. I'm not looking over my shoulder. I'm not going into the bookies. That was probably the first big test I had when I came out of treatment, because it was the first time I would have had access to money. And there was a bookies literally across the road in my eyeline from the office. Like, there was nothing to stop me. But the office itself was crazy. It was in Thomas Street in Dublin, right in the heart of the Liberties. And it was a really old, shitty, fallen down building just next to Guinness's. It was a converted hairdresser's. You'd walk into the office and there's these big gaudy mirrors on the walls. And you're just there, Jesus, what am I doing here? But it was fun, you know, it was fun. There was a good atmosphere in the office. There was good people working there. It was, you know, it was a good place to be. And it was a really good place to be for me because it excited me. It was the first time I felt part of something. I felt accepted. I didn't have anything to prove to these people. Basically, I was living a normal life. First time ever, like 22, going on 23 years of age. I enjoyed the independence of being there insofar as I wasn't living at home. I was on my own two feet. I was able to live on my own. You know, I didn't have any issues. I was able to just live a normal life. And that was, as trivial as it seems, to me, that was a huge thing at the time. After that, after a couple of years, I remember around the mid-90s or so, I actually got to really, really love living in Dublin. I just loved everything about it. You know, the social aspect of it, the work aspect of it. I was driving a company car. I had somewhere nice to live. I had nice clothes. I was able to go on holidays. I was able to do everything I wanted to do. And this is the first time that I could have remembered feeling normal, you know. No worries, no trouble, no debts, no guards. Best time of my life to date. I was able to go out, I was able to date women. I would have been able to put relationships ahead of gambling. Whereas before, gambling controlled everything I did. And if there was relationships, they were secondary or tertiary. Everything now was done on my terms, the way I wanted it to be. I was able, and it's one of the happiest things I've ever done in recovery, I was able to bring my best friend to Barcelona the night United beat Bayern Munich on a day trip. I was able to afford it. I was able to legally get my ticket. I started going to the theatre in Dublin. I never did things like that. Things that I'd always thought about doing. I just tried so many different things, you know, and I enjoyed a lot of it, you know. But I was also very cognizant of my recovery at that time as well, or the image of my recovery. So I was still going to 3 Gamblers Anonymous meetings a week, you know, to be seen, to be the man, as they said. I was sitting down with like-minded people that understood what I was saying, and I didn't have to feel that, oh Jesus, he's an alcoholic, he's not going to understand me. And when I listened to what they had to say, light bulb moments, you know, I mean, I could identify with what was being said. Whereas if I was listening to an alcoholic or a drug addict talking about being strung out on heroin or a guy falling down on whiskey, I'd empathise, I'd feel sorry for them, I can understand the knock-on effects, but I can't fully identify with their feelings. Whereas when somebody starts sharing at a GM meeting about how his life is fucked up, how he stole, how he's fucked up his family life, how he's done all these kind of things, they're things that I can automatically understand and get something from.
Even as he found his feet in Dublin, Pat maintained his connections back in Limerick, particularly when it came to sport. Some of his old friends were now successful rugby players, lining out for Munster and for the Irish national team. Back then, it was still an amateur sport, but that was all about to change. Rugby turned professional in 1995, and clubs in Ireland and in the UK started to compete with each other to sign players. Suddenly, these guys had an opportunity to make serious money for the first time.
These guys wouldn't have been any way, I suppose, commercially minded, we'll say. Next thing, they're being offered contracts to go and play rugby on a full-time professional basis. Eddie came to me, a friend of mine, and he said, look, I've got a couple of clubs in England looking to speak to me, but I'm not quite sure how to, you know. So I said, look, I'll go with you and we'll see how we get on. So we did. They ended up offering him a fairly substantial lucrative contract. He would have been only the second Irish rugby player to actually sign professional forms with an English club. He did this. He was thrilled with everything. And when he came back to the club, there was a few other lads that would have been involved in the Irish international setup at the time. He told them what I'd done for him. They came to me, and next thing, just kind of took off, kind of got legs. I had all these clubs in England ringing me, asking me about this player, that player, the other player. Next thing, I had a journalist from the Tribune, used to be published at the time, had a big two full pages dedicated to an interview with me one Sunday.
So it took me a while, but I managed to find this Sunday Tribune article that Pat was talking about. It wasn't a two-page spread, and I wouldn't really say it was all devoted to an interview with him, but he's certainly a big part in it. The journalist was a guy called Mark Jones. Here's how he describes him, kind of in contrast to the big football agents of the day. Pat Sheedy is a slightly overweight 27-year-old who would look really out of place climbing into a stretch limo. To be honest, for a long time, I wasn't really sure if this article existed, so it was kind of a relief to find it and, you know, to see for myself that it all checks out. I also managed to track down Mark Jones. He lives in Switzerland now. Obviously, he's interviewed countless people in his time as a journalist, but he did remember Pat when I spoke to him.
Mark Jones speaking. It's a vague memory, yeah. The game was changing at the time. It had gone professional in 1995. And, you know, the whole sort of thing was changing. And I think this guy cropped up. I think I can't remember exactly, but I must have been, you know, talking to players or talking to clubs or talking to provinces. And this guy, and maybe I think what was happening was some of the Irish players weren't getting paid sufficiently in Ireland at the time, and were thinking of moving primarily to English clubs in the English Premiership. And I think then this guy's name cropped up as someone who was representing them or negotiating their deals.
Yeah, I managed to find the article that you wrote at the time, and it definitely seems like a transitional time in the game, and Pat seemed to have kind of put himself right in the center of things at that time.
I wouldn't say in the center of things, but I would have had one or two sort of memorable interviews over the years or memorable moments in sport, and chatting to Pat Sheedy certainly wasn't one of them. He just seemed to be a guy who was then piggybacking on opportunity, which is fair enough. But what happened was after the article, what I do remember is somebody from a Limerick club who was in an influential position rang me and said, watch out for this guy. You've got the wrong end of the stick. This guy, you can't trust this guy. You know. And that was really, in a way, the last I heard, I think, you know, in a formal sense. I do remember sort of been getting that red light.
I remember on the Sunday getting phone calls left, right and centre. I thought, geez, you're in the paper. Oh, here's your man, here's your man, here's your man. And next day I'm in the spotlight again. I'm not craving the spotlight as such, but at the same time, it's here and I'm loving it. To me, again, it was pure ego. There was a lot of fanfare with other people and I was loving that, like, which I really shouldn't have been, but it was. I was beginning to miss a bit of time at work because I was running around with these guys and it was beginning to be noticed, and I just had to make a decision on it. I was probably having to go to England maybe a couple of times a week to see clubs for guys, and I was spending a lot of time making phone calls to clubs and things like that on company time and things like that. I still would have had a recovery hat on, as we call it, at that time as well, and I would have had a sponsor, a GA sponsor, who I would have spoken to about a lot of things. I had a chat with him and he just said, look, this is all well and good, but it's fanciful, you know. It could go either way for you. It is gambling to a degree of sorts. Whereas, you know, you have a job that's been very good to you when you needed it. You know, maybe repay a little bit of loyalty to that and stick to what's given you what you have so far. So I did.
And how was the job at that point? I mean, you were knocking it out of the park on the sales side of it. Like, were you still enjoying it? Were you still finding it fun?
Yeah, I was, to a degree. And I was able to use that kind of rugby thing as well against him. And it's you know, I was able to go to him and say, look, this is on the go. I could be off doing my own thing here. So obviously I was, you know, in a bargaining position where I could go to him and say, look, I want a rise. I want a company car. I want to... got whatever I wanted off. When I said that he was enabling me, he was. But at the same time, I was totally manipulating him as well. It was toxic, for want of a better word. It was a toxic relationship. He was money mad, I was money mad. Even though I couldn't really see it at the time, I wanted to get everything I could out of that job. We both just kind of bounced off each other and used each other. He did very well out of it, I did very well out of it.
Pat's boss was a man named Bill Gavin. And according to Pat, the two of them worked together for around 20 years. This was obviously a big part of Pat's life, and we wanted to find out more about it. But like so much of this story, it was more difficult to get straight than we expected.
We spent quite a while trying to flesh out the details we'd gotten from Pat, but we weren't having much luck. You see, Bill Gavin hasn't left much of a trace behind him, at least not in terms of company records.
So there's European Publications Commerce Limited dissolved, and there's European Publications and Services Limited dissolved. There's European Publishing and Advertising Limited dissolved. Printing of newspapers, 24 Thomas Street, Dublin 8. Company directors, there were no directors found. There was no secretary. So there's nothing to see here at all.
Yeah.
There's nothing whatsoever.
We talked to some very established business people from the commercial publishing industry, and they didn't recognize the names Bill Gavin or Pat Sheedy, which was kind of worrying. But they also said it was unusual for ad salesmen to stay in one place for more than a year or two. So that was more of a red flag. Was it really likely that Pat would have stayed in the job for 20 years?
For an ad person,
yeah,
to work for one person, like one, uh-huh, one publication, for that length of time would be like extremely rare.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a very, very long time. in an industry where people move all the time.
It absolutely is, yeah. Now, having said that, I did, when I worked in that, they did sometimes stay loyal if they were well-treated and well-paid, you know?
Yeah.
The office that Pat told us about, the former hairdressers in Dublin, that building was gone when we tried to find it. Literally demolished.
There's one building in that row that's missing completely.
Right. Just one building missing?
Yeah.
There's just one gone?
Yeah.
I know, that would be weird.
24 one of those Thomas buildings Street. Is...
24 Thomas Street.
Gone.
It sure is gone.
I guess it's been demolished.
Nicola, always a bit paranoid, began to wonder if Bill Gavin really existed, or if he was just a figment of Pat's imagination.
Well, that's the wrong name.
Bill Gavin.
Given he's calling him Bob in the book.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, did Pat Sheedy set up that company? And does this Bob exist?
We did eventually manage to track down some of Bill Gavin's children, and we actually spoke to his son, Fintan, who didn't want to appear on this podcast. But Fintan did finally confirm for us that, one, Bill Gavin was a real person, and two, that Pat did work for him for many years. He also told us that his father passed away in 2015.
I was on his RIP.ie, and I saw that he had multiple nicknames.
Airplane Bill.
Airplane Bill and the Duke.
Yeah.
Which... it's John Wayne's nickname, so I thought he must be quite a character if he's got John Wayne's nickname.
He was quite a character. Yeah, he was. You know, I mean, it was the classic example of a kind of love-hate relationship. Like, I don't blame him for any one thing that I ever did. Wouldn't be right. You know, he didn't make me do anything. He saw an opportunity in me. I wouldn't say he took advantage of it, but he certainly benefited from it. And I wouldn't blame him. I mean, why would you? Probably not the highest or most ethical thing someone could do, but at the same time, it suited me, it suited him. Like, he wasn't the one breaking any laws. He was protecting his interests, and so far as I was his cash cow, like I said, hard to blame him for any of that.
So we weren't able to talk to Bill Gavin directly, but Fintan told us that he and his siblings, some of whom worked alongside Pat in their father's company, were well aware of Pat's extracurricular activities, at least when it came to scams and schemes. He said they weren't aware of his gambling. They thought of him as a pathological liar who just couldn't help himself. Fintan said that meeting him was, and I quote, like meeting the devil. Pat had a reputation that preceded him, in other words. At the same time, it's fair to say that regarding Pat's relationship with Bill Gavin, there was two of them in it.
He used to base most of his business in Birmingham.
Mm.
And he had a great fiddle going with Taxman. Like, all of our... when I was calling people... if I was calling people about work, I was always calling from Birmingham, from a Birmingham office. I was leaving a Birmingham number that was diverted over to Dublin. All invoices were done on a UK address, so therefore you were paying the 17.5% VAT. He was paying fuck all to the Queen on the tax over there, and it was all going straight into a Northern Irish bank account that he had.
Obviously, we're not really here to investigate this guy's tax compliance from 30 years ago. We're interested in Pat and whether his version of events matches up with the record. And if Pat says something like this...
like 12 years from 1991 to 2003, 2004, where I didn't bet, I didn't gamble, I did nothing.
We need to go ahead and check that. If Pat maintains that he only scams people when he's gambling and that all of the schemes are just a way to fund that habit... we need to check that too. It's actually a really crucial point for us, not just because we need to trust him, but because of what the answer might tell us about the real nature of Pat's problems. And after talking to all the people that we've talked to and doing as much digging as we've done, one thing seems pretty clear. Pat's boss wasn't the only one with some dodgy dealings going on at work.
What he used to do at work was phenomenal.
This is Kieran Ring. He was an ad salesman under Bill Gavin for around 18 months in the mid-1990s. That's where he met Pat.
And one of the longest-serving member of the staff, the sales staff, that is, was Patrick Sheedy. And what was very evident about that particular organisation was that people didn't stay very long. but he did. He stayed a long time. And I think I might have stayed 18 months after that. But he was from Limerick. I was from Limerick. We had some mutual connections in Limerick. Family, a family in particular that he knew, that I knew. And yeah, we became known to each other. We didn't have a lot in common, but, you know, we spoke. He didn't have a great reputation, which is the first thing that I became aware of. And I would have said overall, it would be he'd be a difficult person to judge. You wouldn't have a lot to go on, is how I remember it. Yeah.
What do you mean by reputation?
So, you know, this line, the client and your client and is a professional relationship. What Patrick had a reputation of doing was taking those professional relationships and personalizing them. And he did that using a particular scam, is probably the best way to describe it, in that he would get in touch with the customer after they had done business, and he would feign being stranded in the UK, having lost license and passport and all the documentation and cash, and then plead with the client to get him out of jail this once, and he would compensate him when he returned to Ireland. But that was that almost seemed to happen weekly, you know, to be frank. It just happened a lot. And then you're left thinking, why doesn't somebody do something about this? The client or the company, our company. But actually, the more it happened, the more you realize that people gave him a pass on that kind of behavior, which I could never understand. He was the perfect victim, you know, because he was able to play the victim card, whether it was his appearance, you know, whether it was his lifestyle, whether it was his, you know, addictions. There was always a reason. It became so normal. Yeah, you just forgave it instantly.
Did he defend it?
No, but his default position was to hide in plain sight. That's his default position. So he was just brilliant at walking out of the room when it came up, or he earned his nickname. We called him Shady Sheedy. And that was why. It was just all shadows. And he lived in the shadows. And that was how he did it. And it was a terrible, I mean, for any of us looking on who struggled with their own demons, because we all do, but Jeannie, he was a hostage to it. He couldn't seem to break it at all. He, you know, sometimes you wondered if he actually ever wanted to break with it. Was it so much part of him, I suppose? I mean, most demons feed off low self-esteem. That the whole idea of not actually thinking a lot of yourself to begin with. So then you have the demon drink, or the demon drugs, or the demon gambling, or they all manifest themselves. But actually, the root of them all seems to be low self-esteem, from what I can see. I definitely think Pat had low self-esteem, but also a sense of entitlement, which is an important thing to try and emphasize. I'm going to take from you what I want and what I need. And even if you see me doing it, I don't know, almost seem to enjoy the fact that people saw him doing it, which is, I've yet to classify that. I have never come across it before or after.
Now, 12 years from 1991 to 2003, 2004, where I didn't bet, I didn't gamble, I did nothing. As they say in addiction terms, I had the life beyond my wildest dreams. I did. I had everything I wanted and more. I had a great job. I had great job offers. I had literally had the world at my feet. I had everything I actually ever wanted before I started gambling, or, you know, I had gotten to a point where I had worked my way up from being a sales rep to a director of the company that I was working with. I had the 5-series Beamer. I had the lovely house in Castleknock. I had the Armani suits. I could go and see Manchester United whenever I wanted. I could go to Rugby World Cups. I could do all of that. And I did it all legally. And I did it all because I was not gambling.
Yeah, my dad was Clareman. Mad, mad, passionate Clare Ireland fan, like, and they won the All-Ireland in 95, and I was able to bring him. You know, it was brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. They're all the kind of things that I was able to do because I wasn't gambling or I wasn't in trouble or I wasn't doing anything. Do you know, they're memories that you just can't buy them. No matter what you do, you'd never be able to buy the memory I have of him in Stanletta. Yeah, yeah. The sheer happiness on his face. Yeah. Can't put a price on that. We had a bad relationship for a long time due to my acting the bollocks, you know. And I used to blame him, or I'd always try and blame someone, and I suppose he took the brunt of it for a long time. And it was only when I had stopped gambling that for that period, and when I was able to go places with him, I was able to bring him to Ireland matches, I was able to bring him to Munster rugby matches, we travelled, all things like that. It was then that I realised that all he wanted, all my mother wanted, all my sisters and friends, all they ever wanted, was just for me to stop acting the bollocks, stop gambling and live normally. And that's all I was doing, was living normally. But by living normally, as we call it, I was fulfilling everything that they would have wanted out of me. Simple, but so complicated at the same time. Yeah. When an addict has a slip, it's generally not a spur of the moment thing. There's always a build up. There's always a reason, or underlying reasons. And for me, they had just been building up over, I suppose, in hindsight, they'd been building up for a year or two beforehand. Early 2000s, I'd say. 2001, 2002, around that time, I'd started to get complacent. I started to fall back into old habits, old behaviours, like not going to as many meetings, telling little lies about not going to meetings, making up excuses, basically justifying shit to myself that I shouldn't have been justifying to myself, thinking again, sure, look, I'm in recovery now, what, 10 and 11 years, what else am I going to learn by going to meetings? You know, I've done all this. I know all this. One of my biggest character defects is my ego. And I started to tell myself that I knew how to do it all again, you know, and I started to believe it. And when I start to believe my own bullshit, the wheels start to rattle. And I ended up going into a bookies and having a bet. Even after I had my first bet, I was physically sick. I mean, physically sick after I did it. I said to myself, right, you need to get to a meeting. You need to go in there. And that was fucking horrific. I remember I went to the meeting on the Navan Road, and I sat down in that room, and I had to tell people that I had been in a recovery group with for years, and I had to admit to them that I slipped. And I was there for hours that afternoon before I go in. Will I, won't I? And I went into the meeting and I was still thinking, will I, won't I, or will I just tell them everything is fine? Because how will they know? No smell of alcohol off my breath. I'm not stoned off my head. None of them saw me in the bookies. Easy for me not to tell them. But no, I said, look, this is where you use your recovery now. You stand up, you have a pair of balls, you tell them you fucked up and see what way it goes. And I did. And I shared, and I remember that meeting, I was the only person to share it at that meeting because what I had to say took so long. And at the end of that meeting, I remember there was tears, there was claps in the back, there was handshaking, there was fellas telling me that they were proud of me for admitting what happened and showing them that, you know, recovery is what it is, blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. And I remember feeling, Jesus, that's, you know, this is powerful stuff, like, this is great. You know, I fucked up, but I'm back on track straight away. I'm back on the saddle or whatever. And I walked out the door of the meeting, I got in the car, and that was it. 7 years before I went to another meeting. Gambling every single fucking day, morning and night. Went through everything I had saved. Back pulling, strokes, scams. Literally back to square. Not back to square one, like back to square one and beyond again. That was it. For the next 7 years, I just went fucking ballistic. Literally.
The Gambler is produced and presented by Nicola Tallant and me, Ian Molini. The executive producer for Go Loud is Owen Brennan, and Darren Cleary is the commissioning editor for Go Loud. Sound design is by Neil Kavanagh. The Go Loud promotion design and video team for The Gambler is Roisin Riley, Siobhan Walsh, Cameron Rooney, Andrew McConnell, and Dara Murphy. Legal support was from Mars Solicitors. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in this series, you can contact Gambling Care on 1800 936 725 or visit gamblingcare.ie.
In the next episode of The Gambler.
At the end of the day, like, I wouldn't have a pot to piss in, but it never bothered me because I was thinking, right, sure, if I ever run out, I'll just pull a straw.
That is the disease. It's about keeping all the balls in the air. But at some point, it all comes crashing down.
You know, and I had always been of the opinion that when I was doing all those things, that life would get really, really, really good. And it didn't.
Keep listening to The Gambler for more.